From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June of 2020. Following the death of George Floyd, activists across the country led demonstrations against police brutality. In some cities, demonstrations occasionally turned to rioting, with businesses looted and some buildings destroyed. David Shore is a Democratic data scientist. He has been right on just about every political forecast dating back to 2008, when he was just 16. And as he watched the demonstrations last year and some of the rioting, he found himself concerned that the goals of the left, racial justice, ending police brutality, would be undone by the images of looting. He tweeted about a study showing that in 1968, nonviolent protests were more effective at pushing voter behavior leftward compared to rioting. He thought he was offering a simple truth, but his comments sparked a backlash and he was fired from his think tank. A year later, Shore is back with an even sterner warning for his own party. The New York Times' Ezra Klein recently profiled David Shore and wrote that Shore sees devastating political losses coming for Democrats in the U.S. Senate, where he says that by 2024, it's likely to be 57-43 Republicans. That's largely driven by a map that favors Republicans. And in the House, driven by issues that favor the GOP. So why would a Democratic strategist say that the issues tend to favor Republicans? Shore says it's because the Democratic Party has become dominated by highly educated white liberals, academic types, and most American voters don't share their values. He worries that Democratic elites are out of touch with the working class, including black and brown voters who drifted more rightward in the last election cycle. So how to stem this trend? Shore says Democrats need to ditch the messaging from the academic elite, who are overly focused on race and gender, and focus instead on the old working class themes that made the party successful for decades. What do Democrats think about all of this? Well, my guests this hour come from a range of backgrounds on the political left, and I will welcome them now. Paul Hippolyte is the founder of Leading With Our Values, a public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Danks Burke is the founder of the president of the Trailblazers PAC, a former candidate for New York State Senate, among other hats she has worn. Leslie, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Evan.
And Jerry Lynn Sparks, former congressional press secretary and founder of the RIGA Democratic Committee. Yes, there are Democrats in RIGA. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Evan. How you doing?
How many Democrats are there in RIGA?
Two. No.
Two of them. There's more than two.
I think we have a little more than 33%.
About 33% of the population there.
Something like that, yeah.
Jerry, thanks for making time for the program. I want to listen to some of what Shore said on a recent conversation he had with Freddie Sayers, who is the host of Unheard, the former editor of YouGov. First, this is David Shore talking about how, in his view, Democrats used to relate better to common voters, the quote-unquote average voter, and he says a lot of that's changed. Let's listen to what he says about that.
If you look at the electorate, white people with a college degree who are under the age of 34 are less than 5% of the electorate, but they are literally a majority of people who work in politics. And so I think, and those people themselves live in circles where everyone is exactly like them. And so I think it's very easy for us to develop an inflated sense of how progressive the electorate is or how much people share our values. And I'll just give, you know, one quote, which is, I think in the US, a lot of people will say, you know, the problem with progressives is that we're too wonky, we talk too much about issues, and we really just need to communicate our values. But our values are actually strange and foreign to swing voters. If they shared our values, they wouldn't be swing voters, they would be liberals. And so the only reason people actually ever support us is because, or ever did support us, was because we, you know, talked about non-polarizing issues that appealed to normal people who didn't kind of share the commitments to solidarity and egalitarianism that activists had. And I think that we've kind of lost the thread and started to communicate the fundamentals of, you know, why how we see the world. And that's really turning a lot of people off.
So let's see. Let's start there. Jerry Lynn Sparks, what do you make of his analysis there?
I think it's pretty good. I was thinking about this last night. So when my parents down in North Carolina, who are lifelong Republicans, when I was a kid, they voted across party lines for Governor Jim Hunt. And the reason they did it is he came out to the rural districts where I grew up, and he listened to the voters, and he actually delivered on things that they were saying, this is a problem for us. This is, you know, our blue-collar working-class issues. He listened, and he delivered. And the same thing with Eric Massa. You know, Eric Massa was in an R+4 district down in Corning for New York 29, and I worked for him. And he outworked the opponent who was in the Republican Party. And the way he did that was he was everywhere. I mean, we worked so hard, and it wasn't just glad handing. He actually sat down and listened with voters, and he made it a 2-year effort to really listen to them and represent their interest. And basically, if you're not representing the interests of the people that are there, then you're not going to get elected. And I think of a political party platform as like a product. I've been in product development. I've been a product director, the strategy for that. And you do customer research. You do, customer discovery. And really appealing to voters is like that. And if you're trying to build a product and the customers are telling you that these are not the features we want, they're not going to buy it. And the same thing goes for a political platform.
Leslie Danksberg, you know, Jerry is talking about what used to be effective at getting people to cross over and vote, whether it's Republicans voting for Democrats or otherwise. But while I think that is certainly pertinent here, Shore is also saying, Leslie, that the political left itself is not a monolith, but its policy and its goals and much of its messaging is dominated by an academic elite that is essentially the farthest left within that group. And therefore, the image that the rest of the country gets is that the left is all that way. And there, and then you lose voters who are sort of toward the middle or, you know, maybe center left. David Shore points out that from 2016 to 2020, there was a 2% swing in Trump's favor among black voters and a 9% swing in Trump's favor in Latino voters. In other words, he's pointing to voters who don't have a college degree, working class voters who are black and brown, who are moving to the right. And so I'm curious to know if you agree with his analysis about what is hurting the messaging on the left.
Well, I think that David Shore is really good at the data, but I think he's falling into exactly the trap that he is describing. Look, who is David Shore? He is a young white guy, and he is not listening to the folks who understand what the Democratic Party stands for. Long time before David Shore made this point, Martin Luther King made this point. You don't win hearts and minds through violence. You win hearts and minds through nonviolent protest. And we got to get back to the basics. We've got to get back to a system where the Democrats are actually listening to the people who are voting. To me, it's not a political party problem. It's an American problem. Later in the analysis of David Shore, he talks about the economic shift that's happening in the United States. It's a dramatic economic shift. The people at the tippity top are getting way, way more slices of the pie, and the folks in the middle class are falling out of the middle class into the bottom. Who sees that? Well, the folks who've been disenfranchised over the last 250 years of American history see that. We've got to start listening to the black and brown people in local communities who are shouting it loud and clear. Look, focus on our issues. Focus on the systemic disenfranchisement of people who already have less. Talk about that. And that's something that crosses racial lines. It crosses party lines. It crosses income lines. It crosses from the working class to the very poor to the middle class. This is something that unifies us as an American people. And when the Democrats can begin talking about that in real ways, not focusing on the intellectual elite and what is the messaging and, you know, how are we going to spin this best? No, get out there and talk with real people and listen to what they're saying. You go talk to folks in the community that I have spent most of my life working in, which is Elmira, New York. They get it across the board. Black and brown people, white people, it doesn't matter what color people they are. They get that they've been left behind. And someone's got to start listening to them.
Yeah, and I think I want to listen to one more clip if we could. It's actually the third clip, Megan Mack. So this clip is sort of an extension on what he's talking about. But I think, Leslie, what David Shore is saying, I can't speak for him, but I think what he's saying here is that he would agree with your diagnosis. What he points out is that there's too much time especially in many different media platforms, in which the left is more talking about whether we should say Latino or Latinx or pregnant women versus pregnant people, instead of exactly what you just talked about. And here's more of what he is elaborating on that.
People who ran the center left, they were socially liberal in relative terms, relative to the and cosmopolitan, but they knew that if they ran on these values, that they would lose. And, you know, what's changed is that as the party, as the country and as the world has gotten more educated, we're now at a point where you can win a Democratic primary, you can win in a mayoral's race in, you know, London or New York, campaigning on cosmopolitan values. But we're not yet at the point where something like that can win a national election, particularly given the structure of our electoral institutions. So I would say the big picture reason this is happening is that, you know, the changing demographics has made people in the center left, I think, overconfident in where the country and where the country is. And this lack of messaging discipline has kind of set in motion, you know, these forces.
All right, Leslie, I'll let you reply there. Go ahead.
So I think he's exactly right. But then he goes on to say, in identifying the problem, he's identifying the problem, right? But then what he's saying is the way you fix this problem is you go out and do polling and you hone your message and, you know, you sit in your intellectual bubble and you continue to not talk to people and you try to figure out what's going to spin them best. People don't want to be spun. That's not what they want. They want to be listened to. And so he's absolutely identified the right problem, but he's got the complete wrong tools about how to fix that.
Paul Hippolyte, what do you think?
I have always been a very huge fan of Leslie Danks Burks. Anyone who knows me will tell you that. She is 100% on board. It sounds to me like David Shore is trying to gin up some more business. And so he's focusing on message discipline and polling. And that's not how you persuade voters. But also, I love data. I love looking at these numbers. I'm not sure if David Shore remembers this, but in 2008 to 2012, we had the first person of color to ever run for president and win. And there were historic turnout in terms of black voters and the percentage that voted for Barack Obama. We also came from an era where we had President Bush leaving office with, I believe it was a 23% approval rating. So it was a year where anyone with a D behind their name would have won, even if it was Donald Duck. It happened to be Barack Obama, but there was a high of 2008 and 2012. There was going to be a dip from that. We had never seen numbers that high before. So Hillary got a little bit less of that. And actually in some of the areas, it didn't, there wasn't much of a budge. But then you had Joe Biden that came after, who was a white male. And there were some issues that people raised both on the left and on the right. And I'm not talking about political right, I'm talking about in the Democratic Party, left mm-hmm. the Democratic sure. Party, right in the Democratic Party, to his policies, to his proposals, to just him in general. And so, yeah, there was a dip in black support for him. There was, but we were at such a high watermark that looking at those numbers and saying, well, we have an issue with non-college educated black voters or Latino, I don't buy that at all. The numbers are still in the stratosphere. If you're looking at percentage-wise, how many are voting, how many voted for Democrats or voted for Joe Biden, the numbers are way up there. So I don't think that we have a particular problem in that area. And I can go on and on. I'll give everyone else here a chance to jump back in, but the idea that even that the Democrats have the issue that they have is a lack of message discipline. I like to say this, and I know we've had this conversation a lot, Evan, but these political parties, they're enormous institutions that don't function like a traditional party that you'd think of in the UK, for example. These are basically modes for power. They're not vehicles for power. They aren't. There is no way to implement message discipline across the Democratic Party nationally or even state by state. The concerns are so different. The interests are so different. The needs are so different that I find that kind of criticism completely useless.
Okay. Well, so the last clip I'll play then, is, and I'll let our candidates, none of you are running for anything right now, I don't think.
Actually, to be completely honest, I have announced that I am running in 2022. There's no district, and you know, goodness knows when Albany's going to get its act together and actually create districts so the voters can know who their representatives are supposed to be. But I'm in there wherever my house lands.
2022, Leslie, you think I can think that far ahead? We got an election next week. So
that's what's most important, is getting people out to vote next Tuesday.
I got you. One of the things that Paul brings up is the fact that if you look at Joe Biden's numbers, they're very, very high. I mean, he crushed Donald Trump on the electoral vote, the popular vote, I should say, and the electoral vote, but the popular vote. But this is something that Shore is focusing on. He says the way, first of all, the U.S. Senate maps are drawn and the disproportionate advantage of rural states in this country, Democrats are in real trouble. That's why he thinks it's probably going to be 57-43 GOP in the next 3 years. In the Senate. And he says, just generally speaking, in the national election, Republicans are still disproportionately represented compared to Democrats. I mean, Democrats get more votes for Congress, and Republicans have a chance to still win the House, even if Democrats get more votes overall. So he's talking in this coming up clip here that we have. He's talking about just how difficult it's going to be for Democrats to win elections because of the way the map is. Let's listen.
Democrats need to consistently get 52.5%, 53% every election in order to, you know, pass laws. And if you look at the Senate is even worse because the U.S. Senate, as your listeners might know, isn't based on population. Every state gets the same number of senators regardless of population. And as a result, rural states, you know, have more power. And rural states have a lot of these non-college whites that have trended against us. And so the bias in the Senate has also dramatically increased. And so the thing that makes me very scared is I think the big question of the next decade is, can we reverse this education polarization? And if we don't, then we're going to be in a position where the other side can have a trifecta and run the federal government with only 48% of the vote.
Okay, so Jerry Lynn Sparks, I mean, those numbers, we can dispute the messaging and his prescription. But he's not necessarily wrong in saying that the way the political map is, Republicans have a big advantage. So Democrats are already up against it there, and they have to know how to sort of peel off votes in the center and even on the right a little bit. What do you make of all that?
I agree with that. And I come from a rural district. I currently live in a rural district. I have lived in Los Angeles, so I've lived, you know, in many different places. But I think the bottom line of what he's saying is that there's three things going on. The people that are running the Democratic Party are, he's saying that they're isolated and they have looked at a class-based argument instead of the education gap. And he's saying that the political platform is not matching what the voters are saying that they want. In the New York Times article, he said that Obama won because they did the customer discovery. You know, they did the polling and they listened to the voters. And when they found things that were not going to get them into office, they didn't talk about those. It didn't mean that they didn't care about them. It just meant that they believed, and rightly so, that it's a lot harder to legislate if you're not elected. So I think I actually agree with what he's saying. And if you can look at some of the local races, you know, here in New York, we've got, let's take the Senate district that Leslie Dinkberg is running for, the 58th district. So her opponent won 54% in the two elections ago, 56% the last time. So there's a need to look at the issues that the voters are facing and making sure that your platform and the things that you prioritize match what they want. Otherwise, you can't legislate if you're not elected.
All right, Leslie. So do you differ with Jerry in any of that?
You know, I don't. The district that I ran in is 32% Democratic. We got 45% of the vote. So we outperformed the party by 13 points. And you're talking with three people on this call who all have outperformed the party by double-digit margins in races that they've run. I have tremendous respect for my two co-speakers here because all three of us have been doing the work in rural districts. And what my gripe with Mr. Shore is thanks very much for recognizing that the intellectual elite are not listening to rural districts, but why don't you come and talk to folks like us who have been outperforming expectations by double digits over and over. We understand how to reach real voters. And I think that, you know, you got to get out of your bubble. You cannot pull your way out of the bubble. I think the one place I disagree is you can do polling till the cows come home, but at some point you got to go actually talk to voters. And we've got to get to a place where the intellectual elite leave their ivory towers and go talk to real people.
I think, Leslie, just generally speaking, what he's saying is that the reason you're probably able to outperform voter registration in your district, or Democrats win sometimes where they're more up against it, is, again, having listened to quite a bit of interviews with him now, you know, he thinks sort of the academic elite is kind of obsessed with, I'll go back and cite the example he used once. You know, do we focus on these working class issues that are setting people further behind when some people are concentrating wealth? Or do we talk about how we can't say Latino anymore, we have to say Latinx? Do we talk about how we shouldn't say pregnant women, we should say pregnant people? He said that's how you lose people, when you do that. And even if you believe in that, just don't talk about it. Focus on what people are really concerned about, because that's not where most of the country is yet. And I guess I'm curious to know if you agree or disagree with that.
Well, I agree with that, but what I disagree with is making it a strategic decision. I believe in being more honest than that. When I have run for office, the folks who have voted for me on the right and the left have known that I stand for certain principles of justice and equality, and sometimes that doesn't jibe with where they stand. I don't hide that, though. I think you've got to be honest about it, but then you've also got to reach people on the places that you can connect. To me, it's not a matter of hiding places that you disagree.
That feels too cynical a little bit.
Making sure you focus.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Does that feel a little too cynical to sort of just look at polling and say, okay, I'm not going to talk about this?
Yeah. To talk about it just as a matter of winning and losing elections. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do in the whole grand scheme of things is bring America back to its basic founding value, that this is a country of we the people. It's not about the horse trade or who wins the elections, or it's about making sure that all the voices are heard. And so if you're just zeroed in on whether your little soundbite is going to gain you an extra vote or two, you're not being honest, and you're not following the American principle of a government by we the people by any stretch.
All right.
I need to step in here for a second.
I know your time is short, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So basically what Obama was doing wasn't being dishonest or hiding things. He just wanted to highlight the things that voters care most about. So the most motivated voters are the ones that are angry, hurt, and struggling. What are they usually most upset about is their paychecks. The survival, the basic unit of survival, is being able to afford food and housing and so many of the things that Evan listed that we're, you know, putting in the party platform. If you look at the top things, those are really things that are nice to have. In product development, we look at the Moscow matrix. And so that's M for must have, and then S for should have, and then C for could have, and W for would like to have. The very first thing that anything you're doing in life, any project, any race, any product, is what are the must-have features. Voters are telling us what their must-have features are, and yet we're putting things on our platform that are not that. So it's a recipe for failure.
All right, last word for Leslie, because I know you got to scoot too. Go ahead, Leslie.
I really think we're saying the same thing, but what I'm saying is do it because you're being honest about your principles. Don't do it because it's a strategic way to win a race.
Yeah, okay, I hear that. So what we're going to do here is we're going to give Paul the floor when we come back from our only break here. Paul Hippolyte's founder of Leading With Our Values, a public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. Leslie Danks-Burke is president of Trailblazers PAC and apparently running for the state Senate again. Is that correct?
That's what I'm doing.
This year.
Some people say I never quit.
Not this year, which is why we feel very comfortable having you on so close to an election that you're not in. Leslie, thanks for the time. It's always nice to talk to you.
Lovely to be with you. Thank you so much.
Jerry Lynn Sparks is a former congressional press secretary and the founder of the Riga Democratic Committee. Jerry, I know I got to let you go, but let's talk soon. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Talk soon. Bye.
Paul's gonna hang there. We're gonna take our only break, and we're right back with him. We'll talk. We'll mix in some more of your feedback as we talk about the future that Democrats are facing. Next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, you're voting for judges. What do you know about the candidates? Most people say nothing. We're talking to candidates for New York State Supreme Court to get you prepared to vote. Then in our second hour, Caitlin Flanagan, the writer, says the private and independent schools, especially K-12, are obscene. But we're talking about whether they can offer public good Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Very curious to get Paul's take on some of where Leslie and Jerry, I wouldn't say they necessarily disagreed. I think what I'm hearing Leslie say, Paul, is that we can't be so calculated that we're only listening to polling on where people are right at this moment and to dictate how we talk and what we are allowed to talk about to voters. Because if we do that, then it becomes this cynical operation and we're going to fall on our face anyway. And it's not going to be authentic. Now, she also indicated she's going to focus on those lunch bucket issues that are driving so much of where people are voting, but she's not going to lie about how she feels about some of these other issues that are important to her. And I think Jerry is saying, you cannot govern if you don't get elected. And it's not that you got to hide who you are. It's that you have to know what is getting the majority of your focus and what do people think that you care about the most. And if you're missing where they are, they won't be where you are. And so I don't think that they're that far apart, but I'm curious to know what kind of where you fall on that.
I don't think they're far apart at all. And I think that if you spoke to elected officials or candidates running in some of the most liberal districts in the country, they would echo the exact same sentiment. And so it's just what those issues are and what is the focus changes from district to district, changes from state to state. So we can all say the same things and we can point to each other as to why this person is right and this person is wrong. But AOC is not wrong for her district. AOC is 97% right for her district because that's what she's winning with. And so to judge how AOC messages compared to how Leslie Danks Burke should message is again, useless. So the David Shore's focus on the national politics, it's hard for me to grapple with that. I mean, even the, I think part of his issue too is, and I don't want to get into this, but he's saying it without saying it. He's talking about cancel culture. He's talking about political correctness. He's talking about all of those things without mentioning it.
Sometimes he kind of mentions it, but he is. That's right.
Yeah. So the Latinx, like who was running for president that was making Latinx one of their platform issues? No one. Or unhoused people versus homeless people. Like, yes, we can change language without making it a platform issue. If he thinks that's why Democrats are losing in Kansas or in Montana, like what? Like, where is he coming up with this? Again, where I would agree with Leslie is what polling are you doing that's telling you that that's what's going on? And did he look at Joe Biden's platform? None of these issues were on there. And it was a
solid platform. You think that's a caricature that doesn't really fit the reality?
Not even close to reality. Mm-hmm. It's laughable. And then, again, the issue I have with some of my friends that are in the data world that are not in the... they use it to make a point when they want to, but it's useless. For example, if the percentage of voters that voted for Barack Obama in Mississippi went from, in terms of black voters, went from 95% in 2012, and then Joe Biden got, I'm just going to throw a way off number.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say Joe Biden got 60%. Did it really matter? So looking at the national focus of black voters and the percentage that slipped, again, tells you nothing. If we all know how someone wins the presidency, it's through the swing states. It's not looking at how many voters dropped off in Mississippi or in Alabama or in New York State or in California. So those national numbers are useless. So why even bring that into the argument? Again, if you're talking to the average voter out there just to make a point, I can see that. But if anyone that knows what it looks like behind the curtain of politics and how to get someone elected, that's not a good argument for me.
All right, let me get back some listener feedback here. Lisa first on the phone. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, after listening, now I'm a little embarrassed to say what I was going to say because I was thinking,
Well, you know, maybe you guys should listen to David Shore, because some of the woke language that goes on, it does turn Republicans off. And I'm a liberal, and I can sometimes even feel myself eye rolling. I'm really worried that in 2022, the Democrats are going to lose really big. And frankly, yeah, language does matter. And if you could vote for a party that was willing to overturn an election and to this day keep saying that it was stolen, I think the Democrats have to really look kind of hard at what's going on.
So what's an example of the kind, as you say, the kind of woke stuff that makes you roll your eyes? What's an example?
Well, you know, Evan, like what you were mentioning, that pregnant people and communities of color, and the reason I'm saying that is because I heard a black person say, we don't even say communities of color. Let's talk real language, because the Republicans in the rural, they don't care. I don't know if they don't care about it, but it's not as big an issue to them as money, health care, survival, you know, using the proper pronouns when you're addressing people. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Paul Hippolyte, what do you think?
I think that the language matters. I don't think that elected officials are running on that. And so I think there's a confusion with the political left, or I guess the Twitter left, versus like how are candidates running in their elections. If folks running in swing districts are focusing on this, I'm going to agree with you that this is a problem. If
they might be, though.
I don't see any evidence for that. Maybe, but I would like to see that first. I think the so much of the debate or the culture wars are being driven by folks on Twitter or folks in the most liberal parts of the country versus the most conservative parts of the country, and it's fodder for the media. But I don't see any evidence that people running in swing districts are focusing on this. And if the language is, if the argument is just over, can we use more polite language to certain groups? Sure. Whether or not we use it, I don't see that as a political fight that happens in the middle of the country or in swing districts.
Okay. But Lisa, it sounds like you're concerned that big losses are coming.
Yes, I am. I really am. Don't you think so?
I certainly don't know. That's why I bring people on much more intelligent than me. That's why Paul's here. So that's why we debate.
Bill, big problems are coming because you have a Democratic president and there's a midterm election. If history serves correctly, there's going to be major losses happening, not only in Congress, but across the country. And that's typical. We're used to that kind of swing, that kind of backlash against who's in power. That's normal. I think
we lost. Oh, there you are, Paul. I'm sorry, Paul. We lost you for a quick sec. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Ezra Klein has talked about this, and we've talked about this on the show a few times, which are the larger structural issues in terms of how the makeup of the Senate, how undemocratic it is, and even the undemocratic nature of Congress as a whole, of the House of Representatives. I think that has way more to do with the losses that we're going to see and the structural disadvantages the Democrats have over the next decade. And I think focusing on whether or not they're polling and having the right messaging, or whether they're talking about Latinx versus Latino, that is so irrelevant in terms of how the country's going to vote and the swings we're going to see.
All right, Lisa, thank you for that. Let me get Robert in Fairport next. Hi, Robert. I missed it. Robert, that's my fault. Let me try this again. Here we go. There we go. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I think that the original guy that wrote the article on this or whatever, I think to some degree he's correct. And I think one of the problems here is that what you hear out of the left these days is a 24/7 victim trawl. It's just fascinating to hear who the next victim is going to be and how are we going to, you're going to cater to that particular victim group. And at some point, this just gets old and tired.
Well, but let me ask you a quick question then. What is it, if not victim trolling, if you lose an election and spend months claiming that you were not the victim of fraud?
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about pocketbook issues. I'm talking about things that move voters. Pretty much everything that Mr. Biden has done so far has made the economy worse.
Now, the economy is actually doing really well in a lot of metrics right now. There's a lot.
The inflation rate is on fire. This is the fastest inflation we've seen in decades.
Sure. And there's a lot of reasons for. I'm not going to defend every decision any president makes. I mean, I think Donald Trump and Joe Biden had very, very difficult circumstances with the pandemic that just about anybody would see certain metrics fall. But there's a lot of indicators right now. Wages are up. I mean, there's a lot of things that do look good. I don't fully understand the notion that we have victim trolling on the left when all we hear from the people who are winning elections on the right is that they actually won when they didn't, and that their entire goal is to reverse an election that they lost. That is victim trolling in the highest degree. Now, I will say victim trolling sells. I mean, it gets you lots of likes and clicks on social media, however you want to define it. But Paul Hippolyte, from Robert's perspective, as a conservative voter, what he sees on the left is a constant rotation of looking for groups that have been marginalized, depressed, et cetera, and sort of scoring points that way, as opposed to dealing with, as Robert would like to see, more of a focus on actually improving the economy. What do you think?
I think he's absolutely right. I think if you're paying attention to Twitter, or if you're paying attention to the media, specifically on the right, that's what you're going to see. That's what the left represents. And that's your conclusion. I'm saying that if you look at reality, and Joe Biden is the current president, where's the victim trolling? Who are these groups that is Joe Biden constantly giving speeches, or his press secretary coming out, pulling out the next victim of the week or the month? Again, there's a reality, and then there's what people focus on in the media or on Twitter or whatever it is, but it's divorced from reality. It's divorced from what people who are running in swing districts are talking about. These are two different worlds we're talking about. So if we want to take the entire political left and put it in one box, sure, I'm going to agree with all of that. But that's not the reality of people who run for office or their advisors. That's not what they're going to tell them to do. And so in that case, then no, that's completely out of left field.
Well, I mean, I'll just reiterate one point to Robert. I mean, I mean no disrespect here, but certainly conservatives for decades have said that the left is always about victimhood and not pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. You lose the ability to even make that argument when you spend a year trying to say that Donald Trump won that election, and that that you want to throw people out of office who will even acknowledge the fact of who won the election. There's something really weird going on that is a cult of personality at minimum, but that is victim culture, and that is the victim ideology, the likes of which I have never seen, and it portends very dangerous things. Now, what Robert's experiencing and what we're seeing in terms of the debate about, you know, as a previous caller said, wokeness, et cetera, that's what David Shore is concerned about, too. And there is a debate to be had. And that's why we've had guests who come from different positions on this hour. I just don't even think that coherently you could say it's just a left thing anymore. The notion of being a victim. I don't know, Paul. I've never seen anything like this ongoing desire to reclaim an election, which has long since been not only litigated, but vetted by Republicans. And Republicans who vetted this properly in Michigan and Arizona and Georgia are getting thrown out of office. Weird things are happening, Paul.
This is also why I think that the David Shore's understanding or messaging or predictions for the next decade and a half, I don't know if I buy any of it. I think since I'm getting closer and closer to the belief that we've all entered an alternate universe since in the last decade or so. But since Trump has been elected, the rule book is thrown out the window. We don't know what is going on over there. And so the idea that there has been hand-wringing the last couple of weeks that Donald Trump is telling people unless he is reinstated, they shouldn't vote this year or next year. I'm not sure if you heard of that, but that's going on. And so we don't know what's going to happen, but what we do know is that right now it's a complete grievance politics has overtaken the right. They're running the show. Anyone who is not in lockstep with Donald Trump is being purged from the party. Where is this going to lead? We don't know. But the idea that the Democrats are completely out of power because of Latinx versus Latino.
Yeah.
Like, we are seeing just absolute mayhem happening on the Republican side. So I don't know how far I would run with his prediction at this point.
Okay, but I think it is still firmly possible that Trump wins in 2024. And I don't mean by overturning legitimate results. I mean actually winning. I think it's still possible. Do you not?
I think it's absolutely possible.
Yeah, okay.
But it won't be because of Latinx versus Latino.
Okay, Herman and Brighton. Herman and Brighton next. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I have two very important points to make. First of all, it's incredibly important that progressives are careful to avoid shooting ourselves in the foot. The messaging of defund the police scared a lot of people away and gave, that and some other things gave Republicans plenty of ready-made messages with which to attack Democrats. The demonstrations, they were 93% peaceful, but 7% were not peaceful, and that gave Republicans more than enough material to make ads scaring the people about riots happening all over our cities. And the other thing is that progressives need to learn to think more strategically and pragmatically. The biggest obstacle right now to passing a progressive agenda is the Senate. So in order to increase rather than decrease the number of Democratic seats in the Senate, we need to focus the messaging on those states that are swing states or even Republican-leaning states, but not deep red states. And we're not the states that we're at risk of losing are not New York and California. Same thing with congressional districts. The districts where, like the AOCs and Ayanna Pressley's, those are not the ones that we're in danger of losing. The ones that we're in danger of losing are the ones that some moderate Democrats managed to flip in 2018, and some of them were able to hang on to in 2020. So the messaging needs to be focused towards helping those Democratic candidates or incumbents. Progressives want to really push things, messaging that may be perfect for AOC.
Sure, for a district like that. Yeah, so let me jump in, Herman. So, Paul, here's what I think I'm hearing. He's saying it's all well and good for the AOCs of the world, those who have safe districts, those who've dominated, have big margins, to talk very freely about all of the sort of the, especially the social justice and the progress. I mean, again, people may call it wokeness or whatever. They can do that. But if they are the dominant voice in the party, if they are seen as the leaders of the party, they are not capable of winning in the swing districts that are real tight. And if that message becomes viewed as the message of the party, fair or not, it's over. They're going to get beat. That's where I think Herman is worried. What do you think, Paul?
The president of the United States has stated clearly that he does not agree with defund the police. And in fact, he wants to increase the number of police officers. New York City, the largest city in New York State. First of all, the governor of New York State, neither the former or the current, have ever stated that they're in line with that slogan or language.
Yeah.
The current mayor of, or the incoming mayor of the city of New York, is a black male who is a former police officer who has stated unequivocally that he does not agree with that language. And so if you're looking again, I keep saying this, if you're looking at the left as an entire...
like a monolith, yeah.
It's useless. Want to look at the political leadership, even in some of the leftist, most leftist cities and states, that is not a conversation that is happening. But if you want to tell me, yes, can Fox News scare white voters with black people marching in the streets? Yes, they can, and they always will be able to do that. Are you saying that the folks who are out protesting need to think to how the Democrats are? Some of those folks are not even, they're never going to run for office. They're not thinking politically. They're not trying. They may not even be Democrats. They may not even be voters. Some of them may not even be U.S. citizens. I mean, there's just an entire group of younger folks that are saying we need systemic change, we need the system to change, and to somehow say that those people are the political left, or we need to find a way to shut down those voices or that expression because it's going to hurt Democrats in 2022 or 2024, that to me is a non-starter, and it's unrealistic. Like you can't tell protesters how they're going to protest or what they should or shouldn't say. But can the right use those folks to scare voters? Yes, they can, and they will.
Jane in Rochester. Hey, Jane.
Hi, Evan. I think that they focus on victimhood probably for a number of different reasons, but it does distract us from focusing on his terrible record with COVID and many more things. So it's the way, you know, I just see we could be discussing his abominable record, and that is not so good and to his advantage since he runs constantly. And I do want to say that I don't like that pregnant people thing. I think all of us know that the only people that get pregnant are, as far as I know, women. Has woman and women become a bad word? Why not say women? But now, like I said, there was one other little thing I wanted to say. It's a terrible thing to forget like this.
I know you were worried about the economy being labeled great, Jane.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we still have this thing. I don't have cable anymore, so I don't hear it. I may be mistaken, but of saying the economy's great, dance, you know, have a good time, everything's fine, as if it is only the stock market. And you've got a lot of people out here saying, huh? It's not good with all the unemployment, all the illness, all the problems we have, housing problems. And so that's what the Republican Party left us with. So that's part of what I wanted to say anyway. I'm enjoying the program.
Well, thank you, Jane, as always. And let me just say, to Jane's point about pregnant people, pregnant women, that is a conversation about people who are trans and understanding inclusive language. There's a really interesting piece in The Atlantic this week from Helen Thomas about why she, who I think leans left politically, is not going to say pregnant people. She's going to say pregnant women. And before you jump to a conclusion about why you assume she would say that, I would ask you to read the piece. It's a very interesting piece, I think well-reasoned. So there's that. But Jane's saying, look, the economy isn't that great, and we're getting distracted from that. It's not, Paul. It couldn't possibly be great right now, given everything that's happened. I'm only pointing that wages are now going up again. There's a lot of factors that are, you know, sort of an open question on where they're going to be in a year. But what are the issues that you will think, that you do think, Paul, are going to motivate people the most, especially when they vote a year from now?
Donald J. Trump.
Still, yep.
100%. I think that anyone running for office this year, next year, the year after that, until he leaves the scene, the focus should be, for better or worse, Donald J. Trump. And he has captured the Republican Party like I've never seen before. I think it's very, very hard, almost impossible to argue at this point that the party has not devolved into a cult of personality. And when he says that he can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, he is 100% correct. If he had a MAGA jurist, he would 100% get away with it. And so I don't know what the next couple of years are going to look like, but I know that people running Look at swing state, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
The folks running for Senate, tripping over themselves to see who is a bigger Donald Trump supporter, even the folks who were deriding him a few months ago. So the Republican Party is 100% fully captured and just absolutely enamored with Donald Trump, and he's going to determine for better or worse the direction of that party. And I think the Democrats are basically in a reacting game for the next couple of years, maybe for the next decade. Hmm. Again, why I'm not so sure about David Shore's predictions, because if this remains, I think the Republican Party will continue to bleed voters. So what does the next 3 or 4 years look like? I don't really know, to be honest. But one thing I know, until Donald Trump is moved off the scene, he is going to be the focus. And then as far as the conversation with I think we are in the middle of a lot of these conversations when it comes to, I'm going to respect the fact that a lot of folks have not heard any kind of conversation or have not had an in-depth conversation about trans people probably until the last 5 years, maybe. I know the bathroom bills in North Carolina started to escalate in that conversation, but we are in the middle of this changing conversation, this changing debate, and I want to give people space to evolve and to change, but I'm going to leave it there.
Paul Hippolyte is the founder of a firm called Leading With Our Values, a public affairs firm. We always appreciate the time, Paul. We still claim you as a Rochesterian, and it's nice to have you back on the program.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Evan.
Thank you, Paul Hippolyte, Leslie Danksberg, Jerry Lynn Sparks joining us earlier this hour, and we appreciate all of the robust conversation from you. Thanks for listening. Rob Braden. Rob's not even here. I'm looking in the booth. It's Megan Mack producing and engineering because she is amazing. Emma Ray Stein's pretty amazing. I'm not. I'm just hosting. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.